From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis, guest host of this edition of PCUSA. Joining me today is distinguished guest Virginia Buckingham, author of the new book, On My Watch, a Memoir. Buckingham was head of Boston's Logan Airport at the time of the 9/11 attacks. For the past 14 years, she has worked various roles at Pfizer Incorporated and recently relocated to Manhattan to serve as their vice president of activation, overseeing the company's digital and social corporate channels and public affairs team. Prior to joining Pfizer in 2007, Buckingham was a political columnist and deputy editorial page editor for the Boston Herald, Boston's number two metro daily. Buckingham was the first woman to serve as chief of staff for two successive Massachusetts governors, and she was the first woman named chief executive officer of the Massachusetts Port Authority, operator of Boston's Logan International Airport and the Port of Boston. She appears frequently as a political commentator on WCVB-TV, Boston's ABC affiliate. In 2015, she was selected for the inaugural class of the Presidential Leadership Scholars Program, a joint initiative of the presidential libraries of Presidents George W. Bush, William Clinton, George H.W. Bush, and Lyndon Johnson. Completing On My Watch was her presidential leadership project, a core component of the program. She is a graduate of Boston College and is married to Massachusetts Supreme Court Justice David Lowy and mom to Jack, 21, and Maddie, 18. She's also the grateful owner of the world's cutest cockapoo, April. Well, Virginia, welcome to Press Conference USA, and thank you for joining me to share your story.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, I wanted to start off with telling your story on that tragic day of September 11th, 2001, when 19 men hijacked four fuel-loaded U.S. commercial airlines bound for West Coast destinations. A total of 2,977 people were killed in New York City, Washington, D.C., and outside of Shanksville, Pennsylvania. On that day, you were in charge of Boston's Logan Airport, where the hijackers originated their horrific journey. So can you tell me how that day started and ended for you?
It started normally, as it did for everyone, really. It was a beautiful September morning, bright blue sky. I had a two-year-old son to get off to daycare and was in my car driving into Logan. I was actually flying to Washington, D.C. that morning to meet with the FAA, with the Federal Aviation Administration, about a key priority of ours, which was building a new runway at Logan to alleviate delays. Heard the report on the news about the first plane and thought, it was a lost pilot, an accident, like so many thought, and then was listening live as the report came across about the second plane. Very shortly thereafter, I got a call from my office at Logan Airport saying six words that changed the world and certainly changed my life forever. Two planes are off the radar. And from there, it was a real flurry of trying to track down what had happened, shut down the airport, evacuate the passengers, secure the planes on the ground, help the families that were coming to the airport to try to find out where their loved ones were. So the day ended very differently than it started, and we all know the world has not been the same ever since.
That is so true, and you were blamed for being responsible in some way for this. What exactly did people say?
So very shortly thereafter, there were a lot of questions, of course, a lot of fear. People didn't know what had happened. And within 2 days, the media started to question whether my leadership at Logan was one of the reasons, perhaps, that the hijackers selected Logan, that there might have been special security weaknesses that we had overlooked. The governor at the time got involved and other politicians started pointing fingers, and it became a real media frenzy. And it became very clear to me very quickly that, you know, the headlines and the radio talk shows, everyone searching for an easy answer, that I was going to be that easy answer.
How did these accusations affect you personally and professionally?
Well, I was forced to resign by the governor 6 weeks after 9/11, And, you know, that was shattering to my career. Of course, I had built a successful career in public service and expected I would spend the rest of my life in public service in various roles. And that was hard. But what was much harder was when I was sued personally for wrongful death by a 9/11 family, reacting to all the media coverage that somehow it was Logan's fault and my fault. That was really shattering to my heart and soul because I considered myself a good person that had worked hard and tried to do the right thing, and that a widow and a mom of two young children, as I was, could hold me accountable and ask courts to hold me personally accountable was absolutely shattering.
I'm sure it was, and I'm sure this was probably the darkest time in your life as well. So how did you find hope during this darkness?
Hope came by people, other people showing me compassion and empathy. You know, it took many years for me to understand why I was blamed and that it wasn't true, but people needed to find a way to ease their fear and anger, and that political leaders kind of played into that. But it really was the kindness and compassion and empathy of others, especially 9/11 families that I've had the great honor to come to know, who embraced me. One mom of a woman who was on United 175 in particular, her name is Ann McFarlane, said to me, "You go rebuild your life in my daughter Marianne's name." And her courage and her kindness really gave me hope.
Tell me about the politics of blame and how blame distracts someone from finding applicable and genuine solutions in a crisis.
So when you're in the midst of a crisis, as our world is even now, I think the thing that leaders must do is keep focused on the problem before them and solve it. And trying to kind of distract attention or assuage fear or find an easy answer is easily done when you just blame somebody else or something else for what lies before you. But that's not leadership. And what I've learned and what I learned through the program I was in, the Presidential Leadership Scholars Program, is leadership requires courage and it requires decisiveness and it requires focus. And that is what is required. And blame is as antithetical to leadership as anything can be.
Even going further with that, when you speak of leadership in a time of crisis, and you mentioned COVID-19, we're presently in a pandemic crisis. So what can leaders learn from this pandemic?
I think leaders can learn that, you know, people want to be led. And that sounds simple, but they want someone to tell them the truth. There's no reason to hide the truth from people. And as scary or as overwhelming as it might seem, tell people what the facts are, what is happening, what can be done. And I think also tell them, you know, that there's no 100% guarantee of safety. There's no 100% answer. I think that's one of the flaws of leadership today in a crisis, is that we can fix everything. Like on 9/11, there was no way to anticipate that hijackers would launch such an evil plan using planes themselves as weapons. Similarly, while some people may have thought and worried about a pandemic, our government wasn't set up to respond perfectly. And the key in a crisis is to learn from it and apply its lessons to the next time. And I think we've done that with 9/11, with our security systems. And I think we're going to have to do that now post-pandemic.
Also, you had mentioned that you had two young children. You had a two-year-old at the time and then a younger child. Going through all this, how did you deal with that as a mom, and then explaining, I guess, as they got older, explaining to them just what exactly had happened and really what had happened to you and your family because of it?
I was pregnant, 5 weeks pregnant on the day of 9/11. And my daughter is now 18, which is just amazing to me how time marches on. And my son is 21. And I think that they learned, I hope, from me that you have to, first of all, be a great mom or a great parent, no matter what is happening around you. And that was my vow to myself, that no matter what had happened to my life and my career, my sense of self, that wasn't their problem. And I was going to be a great mom and raise them to be compassionate and empathetic, aware of the world. I mean, they were very young. And my son, I remember asking, you know, "Mom, why were people mad at the airport?" You know, he's probably six at the time. And I tried to explain about people being afraid, and when people are afraid, sometimes they get angry. And he, you know, tried to grasp that. And he said, "Well, why would those men kill so many people. Why did they do that? And I tried to explain it also very simply that, you know, we love each other. We love our families. We love our friends. And those men didn't love. They hated. And that was the result. And it was a simplistic way of talking about it, obviously. But I'm hoping and I see as they grow up that they have an interest in the world and leadership in the world. And they're really kind and compassionate people.
Okay, we're going to take a brief break, and when we return, we'll talk more with Virginia Buckingham, who is the author of the book On My Watch, a memoir. You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Virginia Buckingham, author of On My Watch, a memoir, a lesson on overcoming personal and professional circumstances and going on to thrive. I'm Kim Lewis. This is a reminder that Press Conference USA is podcast, and it's available for free download on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. That's Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Now back to our program with our guest, Virginia Buckingham, author of On My Watch, a memoir. Well, Virginia, I also wanted to talk about those people that who lost their livelihoods. How do they find something positive in their loss and rebuild their lives, both personally and professionally? And we can even see that going on today.
So I took a while to get myself back on a new path, but I think that's the key for those who have suffered a career setback during this crisis or other crises. And that's to take a moment and take a breath if you can, and actually thoughtfully consider where you want to go from here. It's not necessarily going to be the same path that you were on. I was taken off the path of public service, not by my choice, but I knew deep down that I had other things that I could bring to the table, such as I'm a very strong writer, I have a strategic instinct. So I applied those and actually went into the media after my roles in public service and wrote editorials and columns. And I still do some media commentary. And that was something that I hadn't considered as a career path. So I guess that's the lesson, is to take your time, take a breath, think about what your skills really are and apply them.
Those people that were blaming you and the Logan Airport for the tragedy on 9/11, did that make you feel responsible in any way?
I carried a seed of doubt and a lot of guilt for many, many years because I stopped listening to my inner voice that said, of course I wasn't to blame. Of course this happened at other airports too. And the 9/11 commission found that there was no difference in Logan security than at any other airport, and the federal courts dropped the case. But it really still sat on my conscience because, of course, if I could have done anything to save people, I would have. And it took time for me to start listening again to my inner voice and to say, no, it's not true. I was blamed, but that does not make it true. And I call that in my book On My Watch, being my own hero. I was always looking for someone else to exonerate me, the 9/11 commission, the president, front page of the paper, and that wasn't going to be enough. I had to accept in my own heart and soul that I was not to blame.
And that kind of leads me to my next question, how you talk about how women need to be their own heroes instead of waiting for someone else to save them. Can you talk a little bit deeper in this regard, or what does it really take to get to that point?
So I think it takes recognizing that when you move forward from something so traumatic or shattering, it's really important to recognize that you carry that with you. And so what I found is I had to bring my whole story with me. I had to listen to my own voice, and then I could move forward. And, you know, women in particular, I think, are, you know, taught from a very young age, as I was, you know, through the storybooks we read, the fairy tales we read, that someone else was always going to come along and save you. And, you know, I think that's something that I teach my own daughter, is just not what you want to wait for, even if it happens and you're lucky and someone comes along and does something like that for you. You need to be your own hero, stand up for yourself, listen to yourself, fight for yourself, and help others. Like, be the hero for others. I think that's a really nice way to kind of twist all those fairy tales. Like, be a woman hero for others.
And I think this is so very true, even just on a worldwide basis, because in many places, women do not have a voice, and they may feel responsible or maybe blamed for something, and they feel like they don't have anywhere to turn. So it's basically women helping other women, I guess, in this kind of a situation.
I think so. I think it's just having courage to stand up and speak out and be, you know, shed light for others. I think we all have that potential within us, and I think it's a great show of strength.
Also wanted to talk a little bit about scapegoating and what are the dangers of scapegoating during a crisis?
You know, it's interesting because one of the things I struggled with as I wrote this book is, you know, who cares? I was scapegoated. It affected me, affected my family. Why would readers care about that? And what I came to understand is that scapegoating, of course, has a personal toll, but it also has a societal toll. And when you think about much bigger stories than mine, when you think about, you know, the genocides in our world, the Holocaust, just the harm inflicted on broad swaths of people just because they're different or because of the color of their skin, that's scapegoating. That is at its heart scapegoating. And that is why those terrible things persist in our world. And if we saw them as such, perhaps there would be a way to really fight against scapegoating that leads to such societal harm.
Once it's occurring, then how do you stop it?
I think it's empathy. I think the basis of ultimately stopping scapegoating is empathy. And I think when you humanize a person as opposed to just, you know, stereotype or put them in some category as other, then that is what allows scapegoating. But if you look at people as human beings and have empathy with them as human beings, I think that is the answer. It sounds simple, but it really isn't simple to try to empathize with someone who's different than you.
Looking at the pandemic that we're going through today with the COVID-19, do you think the scapegoating, what part is that playing in this particular pandemic?
Oh, I see it everywhere. And I know it's normal. I know people are scared and I know they're angry. But it's as prevalent as being, you know, angry at your superintendent of schools if they have a plan for learning this fall that you don't agree with. Extends to mayors or governors that, you know, shut down businesses or didn't shut down businesses or say wear a mask or don't wear a mask. It extends all the way to the presidency. And, you know, certainly I wouldn't argue that President Trump handled everything perfectly, but who could? I mean, I think that's the real lesson. Who could in this world on a pandemic that we haven't had in 100 years handle everything perfectly? And I think we're seeing the blame and the scapegoating really, really lashing out at this time.
And I wanted to go back just a little bit and talk more about your forced resignation. And you say this forced resignation did not improve aviation safety. So can you talk more about that?
So, you know, it goes back to that easy answer. So, you know, the governor at the time took me into her office and said, you know, I know you couldn't have done anything to stop this, but I also know you understand how the media and politics works. So, you know, whatever happens, I can sleep better at night knowing that you understand how it all works. And it was such a raw and cynical statement. And, you know, in truth, the rush to judgment and the, you know, forced resignation of me, and they, you know, blue ribbon commission that recommended all sorts of changes, didn't get to the heart of the matter, didn't get to the heart of the terrorists plotting and what holes existed in aviation. Those weren't even the center of discussion. It was all about, you know, my tenure at Logan, and that did nothing to change things. What did change things, I think, was the institution of the federalization of aviation security, which we pushed for right from the moment 9/11 happened, you know, securing the cockpit doors, disrupting Al-Qaeda overseas. Those are the things that were real solutions, not the blame.
And looking at your own personal victory in terms of you climbing out of this dark hole and, I guess, rebuilding your life. So for you, what would you say is the true meaning of resilience?
You know, I felt like I was failing at being resilient, and I thought I was failing at being strong because how I felt didn't fit the societal expectation, the cultural expectation that, you know, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. I didn't feel stronger. What I did feel, though, is that I still was capable of moving forward and building a meaningful, joyful life. And I started to think about maybe resilience isn't that explanation. Maybe it isn't just feeling stronger and putting things behind you. Maybe it's understanding you're broken and carrying that brokenness with you. I use the metaphor of sea glass, which I collect. I'm lucky enough to live near the shore. And, you know, sea glass comes from a bottle that was tumbled apart over many, many years and broken into something that is nothing resembling what it was. Yet it's still beautiful, yet it's still valuable, yet it still brings joy. And I thought maybe that's resilience. You know, that feels more real to me.
And also you wanted to really rebuild your career. So how did you go about doing that? And did you have a hard time finding a job after that? And how did you finally land the job?
So I wasn't a hot property, as you can imagine, after all the controversy. So, you know, I had had my baby. I laid low for about a year. And then I dug deep and thought about what I really did bring to the table, and that was my writing skill. So I pitched myself out. You know, I went back out into the world and pitched myself out for a writing job and was able to get one. And I did that for a few years and then was actually recruited to the private sector and went to work for Pfizer. And I've been there for 14 years and kind of using the same strategic and writing skills that I had used throughout my career. So, you know, it wasn't easy, and it certainly is vulnerable to put yourself back out there after something, you know, kind of derails you. But it also is part of healing.
And also, how do your coworkers, does it matter one way or the other, your background, or do they accept it? Do they still ask you questions about it?
So it's interesting because I had kind of a controversial, high profile, you know, people would comment, you know, she's Googleable and the like. But for the most part, people, if you're authentic and vulnerable and, you know, just put your whole self out there, you know, people respond and have. And I've made probably some of the closest friends of my life in this new career.
You touched on this just a little bit a few minutes ago, but how is moving forward different from moving on?
They couldn't be more polar opposites. You know, everyone told me, from my husband to my sisters to total strangers, just move on, slam the door. You were just scapegoated. It's just politics, you know, bump in the road. And I just could not. I couldn't even fathom how you move on from something so traumatizing. And I came to understand that you can't. You absolutely cannot move on from something that derails you, but you can move forward. And the difference is carrying all of that pain with you, not in a debilitating way, but in an honest way, that this is part of my story too. And you carry it alongside all your joyfulness and your meaningful parts of your life. And it's a whole story then. And that allows you to move forward because you're not denying. You're not denying who you are, what happened. You're carrying it all together.
And that's really good. So basically you're saying is, you know, to own it, yes, this is what happened to me, but this is what I did to really, you know, help myself to move on. And so how would you apply that to today? The pandemic.
So, I mean, kind of I hate to say the gift of the pandemic, but I guess that's a way to think about it, is that we all are going through something, not from the same perspective. And certainly, you know, that saying that we're all in the same boat, but not in the same storm or something like that is true, but we all are going through something. So therefore you can have kindness and empathy and compassion for everyone, because everyone is going through something hard at some level. And I think that's a way to, you know, apply these lessons of kind of bringing us together as human beings who are in a struggle and help each other.
You had mentioned that completing your book on my watch, it was a presidential leadership project, which was a core component of the Presidential Leadership Scholars Program. So can you tell me a little bit more about the program?
President Clinton and President George W. Bush had this brainstorm of kind of bringing their administrations and their presidential libraries together with George H.W. Bush's and Lyndon Johnson's library to offer the lessons that they learned about leadership through the crises that they faced in their presidencies in a nonpartisan way to change makers who want to make the world better, whether in a small way in their own community or in a bigger way. And so they started this program in 2015, and I was part of the inaugural class, and it's, you know, was 60 people that were brought together from all walks of life, you know, people that were trying to build better services for veterans, for example, or people who are running relief agencies overseas, or people who are running service programs here, volunteer programs in the United States. And the beautiful thing about it is they were from all kinds of political perspectives, but it didn't matter because it wasn't about that. It was about how do you lead and how do you try to make the world a better place. And in the 6 months that the programs meet, and they have met each year since, a new class each year, you work on your project, and mine was completing my book and trying to distill the leadership lessons from it. And you just really try to draw from the presidents who personally participate, you know, what it was that allowed them to face things like the financial crisis of 2008, for example, and you meet with members of their administrations and you really delve into what it takes to lead. And it's a real gift to the world, a generous gift to the world that those presidents have given.
How did you get selected for the program?
Well, it's kind of like when I talk about getting into college now. You know, I'd never get in today because it was the first class. There were 900 applicants, and they selected 60. And, you know, we did interviews and told them about our projects and what we wanted to accomplish. And, boy, am I grateful I was chosen. And we still meet regularly, of course, in these times by Zoom. And each class has become, you know, part of our family. And we all try to help each other accomplish whatever we are each trying to do to make the world a better place.
Was it really hard to sit down to bring back all of these memories to put down in a book? And they were, a lot of them were not good memories.
You know, the book took me 13 years to write, which is an awful long time. And I think it was because I could tell my story, even the painful parts of my story, but it took a lot of time and perspective to understand what it might offer to readers, what I might be able to say about resilience or about the destructiveness of blame or about being my own hero. And those were the things that the Presidential Leadership Scholars helped me delve into and understand. And ultimately, you write a book for readers, you don't write it for yourself. So I'm grateful that I was able to finally put it out in the world and hope that it finds its way to the people who want to read it.
Are you thinking about a next book, and what would you like it to be?
Of course, I'm thinking about a next book. You know, the great American novel. Every writer wants one of those. So that's somewhere in the back of my head. But I do think I have a second nonfiction book that I'd like to bring forward about how do you move forward once you learn the lessons. So, you know, I want to build a life of meaning and joy. How do you actually do that, you know, at my age with my kids grown and, you know, playing with it, not getting very far yet, but I'm looking forward to less than 13 years getting it out in the world.
That's great. Now, on that note, we're going to have to end this most fascinating interview. My guest is Virginia Buckingham, author of the book On My Watch, a Memoir. Thank you so much, Virginia, for sharing your insights on your life-changing experiences and lessons that you not only have learned, but all of us can learn from unimaginable circumstances. Press Conference USA was produced in Washington. I'm Kim Lewis, and be sure to join Carol Castiel next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.